French pussycat, a very special kind of woman, curious about life and what makes living so much fun. Men, they can get you in all kinds of trouble, and I love it. If you want to see the kind of trouble I'm talking about, come see my story. Come see French Pussycat. You're gonna love it. Rated R.
Hello and welcome to the Alternative Cinema Podcast, the internet radio show for folks who love to watch and shoot low-budget, independent feature films. My name is Michael Rosso, and
Happy New Year.
It is January 1st, 2011, and, we made it. We're in our second year here at AC Podcast. It's a great, great, great show today. In a few minutes, Joe Kolbeck will be coming in. And we'll be joined by none other than Video Violence Captives filmmaker Gary P. Cohen. Gary wrote and directed these amazing direct-to-video films in the late 1980s, and he has quite a bit to say about his experiences making those films, as well as his experiences when he worked in New York City in the 1970s. He has his own grindhouse experiences, which I'm sure you'll love to hear. You know what I've not mentioned on the podcast in the past, and I should have mentioned, and I'm going to start to mention, is the fact that Alternative Cinema has a print catalog of DVDs. I don't know if everyone listening is aware that a print catalog exists. Alternative Cinema carries titles, of course, from our in-house studios, Camp Motion Pictures, Seduction Cinema, Shockarama Cinema, After Hours Cinema, but did you know that Alternative Cinema also carries Blue Underground, Synapse, Video X-Pix, and many others? It's a catalog that probably has close to 1,000 titles, if not more. Well, you may say, well,
How can I get this catalog? I want this catalog. How can I get it?
Just send me an email at alternativecinemapodcast@gmail.com. In the header, put I want a catalog, include your name and address, and I will personally put a catalog in the mail to you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have the gang here, Gary P. Cohen. We have a great show in store. So stick around. Don't forget, if you don't have that AC catalog, send us an email, alternativecinemapodcast@gmail.com.
Yo.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have a fantastic show.
Hi, my name is Butcher.
I'm Brain Chomper.
And I'm Gambling Man.
We're here to tell you about our show, The Killer Reviews Podcast. Each week we discuss movies new and old, talk about our lives, and every once in a while we'll have interviews like Fred Vogel from Toe Tag Pictures, Daniel Harris of the Halloween franchise, and Charles Gibson, the special effects supervisor for Terminator Salvation.
We also have special episodes like our full review of the Alien Quadrilogy, A Nightmare on Elm Street retrospective, and Clash of the Titans.
And we're also very, very sexy.
Especially you, Gambling.
Yeah.
Our podcast is available at killerreviews.com.
And if you sign up for our forums between now and 2012, you enter a chance to win a romp in the sheets with Big Butch.
Hey, it's Mike Rosso, and I'm here to tell you about
the Pink Delicates
and their full-length album,
Who Stole the Quiet Day?
You've heard lots of cuts here on the podcast, and you can check out their full-length album by going to cdbaby.com and searching Pink Delicates. Their music is right there, ready for download purchase or buy the CD.
Check out the Pink Delicates.
Who Stole
the Quiet Day?
Oh, Hey, this is Michael Rosso, producer of the Film Photography Podcast. If you visit our newly revised homepage, filmphotographypodcast.com, you'll notice that in the upper right-hand corner there's now a donate button. This means we want you to get involved. You can donate a vintage camera,
as long as it works,
some film, or U.S. dollars, which we'll turn around and put right back into the podcast. Filmphotographypodcast.com. Thanks for listening. In the studio today. To my right is Joe Kolbeck. Hi, Joe.
How you doing, Mike?
Joe is the editor, film editor, for this particular project. He remastered the Video Violence and Video Violence 2. Our very special guest is Gary P. Cohen, who's right in front of me.
Hello.
Hi, Gary. And I'm thrilled to be talking about the late 80s direct-to-video feature films that Gary directed. And if I may, Gary, I sort of pinched this from the internet. It's a bio on you.
Uh-oh.
For okay. The folks out there, for the folks listening to this commentary, or if you're listening to this on iTunes, you may know Gary only from his work in horror, Video Violence 2, and Captives. But in fact, Gary, you've done a lot more work.
Yeah, I'm primarily a theater producer.
Yeah, but according to the web, this very well-written bio, Gary P. Cohen is the producing director for Middlesex County, New Jersey's Plays in the Park. Over Gary's diverse career, he has been a theatrical agent for the William Morris Agency.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yes.
Founded his own theater company, Celebration Playhouse, in the 1970s, acted in many plays and musicals, and created lighting and set designs for Plays in the Park and other New Jersey theaters. In addition to directing, Gary at Plays in the Park has worked for the Bickford Theater and the Forum Theater. He has written two books about the theater, which I found awesome,
okay.
The Community Theater Handbook and the Theater Director's Primer, both published by Hyman Publishers and available online at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Now, along with Mark Barron, you have written a children's musical, The Reluctant Dragon.
Actually, two now.
Oh.
So, yeah,
okay.
There's a new one that's been released.
According to this, Gary, you are a horror film fanatic. You also wrote, as we know, wrote and directed two groundbreaking shot-on-video horror films, Video Violence and Video Violence 2, and they've become cult favorites. And, of course, we know that Camp Motion Pictures remastered those titles a few years ago and put them out on DVD, which is why my great pal, Joe Kay, is here.
Thank you.
Joe went through the task of going through all those old VHS and 3/4-inch masters,
yes,
digitally re-editing them in an Avid system, and yes, then outputting to a digital format, which is why Video Violence 1 and 2 look so great.
Yes.
So welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
And welcome, Joe.
Thanks.
Gary, I think before we get into your horror film career, tell me about your affiliation with the William Morris Agency.
Right out of college, right out of Hofstra University, my dad knew someone in the Morris Agency, and I got a job in the mailroom. And I was very proud in that. I was one of the quickest people to graduate to being a theater agent. I think I went through the mailroom, the teletype machine, which I'm sure no one knows what it is, but
right,
the old teletype machine, to being a secretary, to actually being an agent in like a record 2.5 years. And then I really didn't like it very much at all. I was not happy once I was an agent. So I did that. I think I stayed there for another 6 years.
Oh, okay.
And then kissed New York goodbye for a while.
See, the William Morris Agency, I mean, as a prestigious organization, correct?
One of the two biggest, absolutely.
Wow.
In terms of agencies, theater agencies.
If I could play a fan for a second, did you see any celebrities in your many years there?
Oh, I was actually friends with some and represented a whole lot. Most famous, I suppose, being Robert Preston, Susan Sarandon, who's a New Jersey girl, Ellen Green. Well, yes, I certainly, yeah.
And did you, at that time, were you a New Yorker? Were you actually living in New York?
No, I was still in Jersey. I lived in New York a lot during Hofstra days, but then I moved to Jersey. But I do have a good horror-related William Morris story.
Oh, very
May
nice.
May I take a moment to
Oh, please do.
All right, so Carrie had just come out. Brian De Palma's Carrie. And when you saw Carrie initially, it was scary.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, now it possibly isn't, but then it was. So I'm a secretary at William Morris at this point, and I'm sitting at my cubicle, and I'm typing away, and I get a tap on a shoulder, and I turn around and I look over my shoulder, and it happens to be Sissy Spacek, who I had no idea was coming up to the office, and all I saw was Carrie with the blood. And I screamed, and then I just had to apologize to her profusely. I'm sorry. I had just seen Carrie this past weekend. You scared the crap out of me. And she thought it was funny. She didn't mind.
What was her initial reaction to that?
She screamed.
Oh.
Because I scared her.
Wow.
Someone she tapped somebody on the shoulder. They turn around and scream in your face. She let out a shriek.
That's fantastic.
People came running. What's the matter? But nothing was the matter. So that's my William Morris story.
Why do you think that your experiences at William Morris, like your experiences as a sales agent, was the job description or the pressures of the job much different than your other aspects of what you did there before?
Yeah. I don't think I could get in trouble particularly in saying that William Morris really, at least then, was all about money. You had to have a killer instinct in your negotiations with the producers or the casting directors or the general managers of the theaters. I was in the theater department specifically. There was very small chance of being friends because all you were doing was fighting for your client. Well, somebody has to do it. It just wasn't up my alley. Right. I didn't have the killer instinct that they wanted. I had a wonderful time going out to opening nights and becoming friends with the actors. But the nature of the job is to have a killer instinct.
Now, being at William Morris, at that time, did you already have theater directing or acting experiences from your college days or high school days even?
Yes, and I was simultaneously running that Celebration Playhouse during the William Morris days too. In fact, Richard Chamberlain came out to see me in American Buffalo. He thought he might want to do something on stage in a little theater. It didn't pan out, but you can imagine having Richard Chamberlain in the audience back then.
Yes. Back then in the 70s, Richard Chamberlain was an amazing television star.
Absolutely.
Series like Shogun, am I correct?
Yeah.
I mean, he was, you know.
And Dr. Casey or Kildare, whichever one he was. So that was a thrill. I felt that I wanted to do something creative, not something based solely in money.
Right. So I guess I would imagine that at that time you started Celebration Playhouse and then just figured, did you become a full-time member of Celebration Playhouse?
Celebration Playhouse was an oddity. I don't think it could exist today. There were three of us. We were in a feed and seed store in Cranford, New Jersey, a renovated feed and seed store. And while a lot of the other community theaters around us, and there were community theaters, were doing The Odd Couple and What the Butler Saw or How the Other Half Lives, we were doing all the offbeat stuff.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I was sometimes even using my William Morris connections to get offbeat stuff. Richard Peasley, who wrote the music to Marat Sad, if you remember that play.
That I don't know.
The entire title is called The Persecution and Assassination of Jean-Paul Marat as performed by the inmates of the Asylum of Charenton under the direction of the Marquis de Sade. And it is about a theater production in an insane asylum where Marquis de Sade is one of the patients, and he leads the actors to such a frenzy. They're doing a play about the French Revolution. He leads the actors to such a frenzy that they break out at the end. It's a wonderful show, Royal Shakespeare Festival. Well, this fellow, Richard Peasley, did the music to it. He had a musical review. We were one of the first to do his review of his songs through that connection. So we were doing very, very offbeat stuff at Celebration Playhouse, and it ultimately just became too expensive.
Right, right.
Yeah. Same as always. That part is still true.
Were the sensibilities, if you could talk a little bit about the sensibilities of the time. I mean, this was the 1970s. You're working in theater now. Was it a different vibe? Can you tell me a little bit about the 70s vibe? Was it looser? Were people different back then?
Absolutely. No doubt about it. I'd be lying to say it wasn't to some degree done under a cloud of weed. Some of it was.
Right.
But not all of it, of course, but some of it was. But here's an interesting story about the time that this could never happen today. It's a little earlier. I guess it's probably the very early 70s. My friends will correct me, but whatever. Hair had just opened off Broadway, and then Hair had moved to the Cheetah, and then Hair had moved to the Biltmore. A bunch of us got together, went up to Michael Butler's office, the producer, sat across the desk and said, we want to go see Hair with a tape recorder. We want to record it, and then we want to do it at Rutgers University. And this man said, yes. Wow. I mean, nowadays it's the $1,000 a performance to have the royalties of a show. And we did it, and he said yes, and we went back to Rutgers University, and we sold out. And finally, I believe he called and said, you got to stop, because you're selling out.
Oh, okay.
You're running the show while we're running the show.
Right.
He wasn't mad. He just said, you better stop.
Yeah.
That won't happen today.
Yeah. What is it like today if there's a popular show on Broadway? What does it take for a college or high school theater? Am I correct in saying that now, basically, after amount of time, the license is available for people to pick up?
Once the show closes, generally, it will take 3 or 4 years before you can do it, because there will be tours. And Plays in the Park, for example, which is in Edison, has the mixed blessing of being close to New York. The positive side is close to New York. We can go, and we can see shows, and we have all the resources of New York at our disposal. The downside is we cannot get a show as quickly as they can in Omaha because we're 10 miles away outside of New York.
Gotcha.
So if the show has to play the New Jersey PAC, then it has to play the State Theater in New Brunswick. Then if Paper Mill wants to do it, they get to do it. So we don't get to do a show quite as soon as some of the other places, but generally 3 years out. We're just now, this coming summer, we're getting to do Hairspray, which closed about 4 years ago.
Are theaters categorized in tier? For example, is Broadway, Off-Broadway? You mentioned NJ PAC, which is in Newark, New Jersey. Does that theater, NJ PAC, have more priority on getting a show than, let's say,
it's plays? Very simple. There, it's only two tiers. You're either equity or you're not equity.
Oh.
So if you're equity, they're going to get more royalties, and they're going to get the shows before any amateur theater is going to get it. We were very close to doing Jesus Christ Superstar, a 35-year-old play.
Yes.
This coming summer, they said no, because we're too close to New York and there is a potential for a revival.
And
so we can't do it.
How about that?
If you don't mind explaining equity, what does that mean exactly?
It's called, you would say, an equity show. It probably also has to do with all the other unions. Equity is the actors union, actor and stage manager union. And therefore, they govern how much the actors get paid. Now, it's at Plays in the Park, we don't pay the actors at all. So it becomes, now there are tiers of equity. There's Lord C and Lord D and Lord, those are all the different tiers of how much that theater has to pay the actors or how many equity actors they have to use. But equity trumps non-equity regardless.
Right.
So a professional theater trumps the community theater, trumps the college, trumps the high school. Now, the funny thing about it is Les Mis and Rent and Phantom, which we can't touch, are being allowed to be done on a high school level. As long as the cast is under 18, those shows have been released. I did Les Mis at Cranford High School 6 years ago.
That's very interesting.
But I can't touch it. It plays in the park.
Is it because you're perceived as professional and a high school is more of a training ground for young people to?
Yeah. The composers and the licensing agents decided that will make Les Mis, an educational property available to high schools, but not. And I've been waiting for Les Mis for years. I thought maybe this summer, but the paper mill is starting a new tour. Right. So again, we're trumped.
Have you considered like doing like a Rodney Dangerfield kind of all your players go back to school in order to qualify to get the license?
No respect.
I'm kidding, yeah, of course.
No, you know, we can't. We couldn't even do it at Plays in the Park using kids under 18. Oh. You've got to be under school's umbrella.
Very good. Between Celebrity Playhouse and Plays in the Park in New Jersey, where you currently still are, what was the gap there? When did you start working at Plays in the Park?
Listening, but there was a gap. When Celebration Playhouse folded and when I left William Morris, I was a little angry at theater, irrationally angry at theater. I actually started a tropical fish store with a partner who wanted an art gallery. So we had a place called Pisces, which represented the fish, Capricorn, which represented the art, and we sold tropical fish in one half of the building and art in the other. Again, a good idea. The practicality of it is the people who came shopping for art got distracted by the fish. And the people who wanted to schlep these guppies out of there and goldfish, they were thrown by the art. So that folded, and that's when I grabbed onto the burgeoning video store business.
Oh, very good.
And I was one of the first, way before Blockbuster, I had a mom-and-pop video store. Well, now we lead right to Video Violence. Video Violence is featured in those two video stores, and that's where the story of the girl who came in and asked me about... Should I tell that story?
Sure,
okay.
Sure. Well, let me ask you a question.
Okay. Let's go back to the story later. It's a fun story.
Oh, okay. I just want to kind of get an idea of year here, because I'm fascinated by our pop culture and our society and by year. I find it completely fascinating, the fish,
yeah,
art gallery. What year was that?
Okay. Everything that happened between 80 and 89. 89 is when I, no, 80 and 86. 86 is when I joined Plays in the Park, and 80 is when I left William Morris and Celebration Playhouse. So in those 6 years was the tropical, and it really was saltwater fish. It was pretty fancy.
Very nice.
I still even remember the Latin names of some of them. So it was saltwater fish in the gallery into the video stores, all in that 6 years.
Right.
Palmer yes. Video had two or three stores. Video Studio, of which I became a part of, had four or five stores. I owned two of them. Palmer became bigger, but then Blockbuster wiped us all out.
Right. I am fascinated by the fact that you owned and ran a mom-pop video store.
Yeah, right. Two of them.
What were they called?
Video Studio.
Oh, that is great.
The Video Studio.
And it
was a franchise.
And this is in New Jersey.
They all were.
And what?
All six of them.
What year, if you can recall, did Video Studio open its doors?
Well, I'm going to say that it would have been 84 through like 87.
Okay. 84 is, for those folks listening to this, it was like the golden era, the rainbow era of VHS video. I personally, my family had a VCR in 1977 with the RCA Selectivision.
Yes, I had, yep.
Yeah, and for a few years there, I would have to, like, you know, as a kid, take a bus to New York, go to a really big store to find pre-recorded video. And then slowly in the early 80s, 80, 81, started catching on. But by 84, it was a literal explosion where there were stores in North Jersey. Sometimes on the four corners, and on two corners there'd be two stores, because there was such a demand to rent videos.
I'll never forget the day that the first VHS hi-fi unit came to my store, and there were about six of us, and we set this thing up with a stereo, with an old stereo and some speakers, and suddenly there was hi-fi sound, and I think it was Close Encounters.
Okay.
And we were losing our mind,
yes,
about this hi-fi sound.
Yes.
You saw the little VU meters. That was non-existent in VCRs,
yes,
prior to that. Do you remember the one with the clock on the top?
I do, yes.
And do you remember Wometco Home Theater?
Oh, my God. Wometco Home Theater. We just released a DVD compilation of softcore films.
That were on Wometco?
It's called the Scrambled Sex Collection, because It was sort of it's an homage to Wameco Home Theater because so many communities.
I didn't think anybody knew of it.
So many communities. You must be an Uncle Floyd fan.
Oh, of course.
There's so many communities in the early 1980s. This is going to be difficult for listeners to believe. There were towns and small cities that had no cable because there was no line. There was no cable line running the area. So whereas a few places started, carrying cable and having something what was known as HBO, home box office.
Not even HBO, it was home box office.
Which I think was launched in maybe 72 or 74. You were just out of luck.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, a company called Wameco Home Theater launched a service whereas they put an antenna on your roof and you were able to tune in through a UHF channel. Of course, UHF, everyone thinks of Weird Al.
Right.
Thanks for Weird Al for letting people through his movie know what UHF even is.
Well, you did on Channel 3.
Yes.
Right? Or 4 if Channel 3 was your popular one.
The channel selector would go 2 to 13 and then U.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Okay. Just
and folks, Jaws was the only movie you could get.
For folks out there listening who can't comprehend what we're talking about, you had a TV, and there was a selector on it where you turn
a dial,
channels 2 through 13, and then if you were lucky enough to have a TV with UHF, the next channel would just say U, and then a dial under the top dial would light up.
And that wouldn't click. That was a smooth one, and you had to go back and forth and try to tune the station.
And you had channels like maybe channel 28
through
41.
And that was it. But and none of them came in.
We had Long Island.
Right.
That came in.
Right.
And Channel 68, based out of Newark, New Jersey.
Right.
Came in. And Channel 68 would play shows like Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. That's how I discovered what was known as the Uncle Floyd Show. Yeah. And then about 8 o'clock at night, maybe a little earlier, the signal would get scrambled.
Right.
And you still hear the audio,
but
you'd see major motion pictures like Jaws.
Right. Well, I only remember Jaws. Okay. And then you got Wometco, and you'd tune. Now, mine wasn't on the roof. I was in an apartment, and I had to have the antenna outside my bedroom window.
Okay.
So you saw it hanging
like
outside.
Like a satellite dish.
Yeah, you saw it hanging outside the window. Did it last 2 years, if that?
According to the Wikipedia, it lasted about 8-10 years.
That's unbelievable to me.
I think a lot of people dropped out once the cable came to their neighborhood.
Okay.
So, but after 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, well, they had these softcore sex movies, mostly European, West German films, some Swedish films. Well, that's sort of like the precursor or parallel to blossoming Cinemax, which didn't exist yet.
Yeah. And if you were really smart and you knew how to do it and you didn't care about legalities, you would get your Betamax set up with your 1 hour beta tape and you'd tape this softcore stuff.
Yes.
There's no more to it. Why? I would make copies of it.
The beta would descramble it?
No, I'd go through Wometco. I'd hook Wometco up through the beta and then I would tape it on these 1 hour tapes. That's all you got out of the tape.
Right.
Was 1 hour.
Joe, do you have any
questions? I remember beta. I was going to say televisions came with a designated U station. The station was it was just U on the dial. Okay, did all TVs come with this?
Most. From what I recall, every TV that
I had two different kind of antennas. You had a UHF antenna which was round.
Yes, on the back of the TV.
And then you had rabbit ears.
Most TVs had rabbit ears built in, although some were set up.
You pull them up.
You pull them out, an actual antenna. And then behind the rabbit ears was another antenna, a little round antenna.
And that was your UHF one.
Okay, because of course I was too little to actually know what this was, but I remember back then the U on the television. I never knew what that was for.
And the TV channels, you could click from 2 to 3 to 4, but the UHF was a round like a radio dial.
Even the early remote controls. Like clunk. They would like clunk.
They used to call them clickers.
Clickers.
That's where clickers came from.
Yeah.
You had two buttons and that was it.
Your grandma would be like, pass the clicker.
Yep.
Right.
Who gets the clicker tonight?
This is more than I could ever have hoped for to talk about. And what was your experiences like? First of all, I'm getting the impression that, I must back up. I had to talk about stereo VHS. I bought, when it first came out, probably in the very early 80s, Pink Floyd at Pompeii came out on Harmony Video in a hard shell case.
Right.
And that was fascinating to watch.
Well, you had to be stoned for that. Well, no, you did. That was the strangest Pink Floyd in the world. It made no sense. It was all a lot of noise.
Yes.
And but you just loved it.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Pink Floyd, Pompey. Right, Pompey. Well, I also had, here's another
one. Now, you were like a videophile. You really loved this stuff.
I was crazy. I had the I'm going to say it wrong, but you'll correct me. I had the video disc before the laser video disc. Now, I also had the laser discs, but I had the one that was in a cartridge, and you stuck the cartridge in, and then you pulled the cartridge out. CED, was it?
Now, CED would have been an early DVD format.
No, okay, so this was an RCA.
What? I might be incorrect.
I have no clue.
This was a laser disc. This was a record. The movie was on a record. It came in a caddy. It was 12 inches. RCA Selectivision was the only company that made it.
Really? So they made a disc for
that? They made a disc, and then Laser blew that out of the water the way VHS got rid of Betamax.
There were two versions of Laserdisc, an early version, and then it...
Oh, that's true, too. There was a very clunky one that would get laser rot in about 3 minutes.
What is laser rot?
The picture would disintegrate.
Oh.
It would just simply disintegrate.
Wow.
You'd spend $30 on your copy of 9 to 5.
Yes.
And you'd have nothing in a month. You ought to look up the RCA Selectivision.
I will.
It was a fascinating... I remember there was a store. We all had 40, 50 of these things because it went out in about a year. And one store decorated, used it as wallpaper. The caddies was the whole wall of this video store. When I say caddy, it was a 12-inch plastic thing. I don't even know if I know how to explain it. See if Wikipedia has RCA Selectivision. But anyway, so then I had lasers.
Yes.
So I was I probably bought Jaws in VHS, VHS Hi-Fi, Selectivision, laser, DVD, and then... the new DVD HD.
You like Jaws, no doubt about it. Is that your favorite?
No, but that was always like one of the first ones to come out.
Right.
Oh, I love it, but it wasn't my favorite.
Tell me about what the experience was like and how you got into the video store business. Like, did you get with someone like, let's start a video store? Like, how did you? What was the evolution of starting a video store?
Well, I'm almost a little embarrassed. But not terribly embarrassed.
Okay.
So I'm at a time period where there's probably only three video stores in the area. And I happen to have been a Triple X video aficionado. So I wound up somehow being the consultant for a video studio in, I'm going to say, Garwood, where he would ask me what X-rated, remember the big box, movies, which ones to get. And it even got to the point where there were brokers who would come to your video store with cardboard boxes full of X titles, and you'd pick them right then and there. He would tell me when the guy was coming and say, well, why don't you come and pick the half a dozen that I'm going to buy this week?
Right.
And then he used to just let me watch them first, and et cetera. One day the guy says to me, and he had two stores, and I must have been telling him that the fish store wasn't doing the business we hoped, and I had someone who was interested in buying it. And he said, well, I'll franchise you a video store. You know what you're doing.
Wow.
And I went back to my wife, ex-wife now, probably because of this, but and said, you want to run a video store? And she said, yeah, let's do that. And then one led to another one. So we had one in Island, New Jersey, and one in Bound Brook, New Jersey. And you always had a back room, and the back room was where the X-rated stuff was.
Some that had an old-timey, like, Western Corral door.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right, a swinging bar door, or you had a beaded curtain hanging up.
Yep. You know, I feel maybe we could talk for hours here. I have to ask you, first of all, it seems like you may be an expert at early 1970s adult films. Mark Stevens, Jamie Gillis,
right.
Tina Russell.
Right.
So you're really familiar with this whole scene.
Absolutely. Who was the one? She was great. She was also a dancer. Tall, and because I used to ride my bike with her in the village. I'm very bad in my old age at names. It'll come to me, or I'll think of the movie. But she was legitimately a dancer. And she dances in a couple of the scenes. What's the movie where she says, ripe mangoes, Does Ripe Mangoes ring a bell?
No. Yes, yes, it does.
Yes, yes, yes. It does. Okay, you know what I'm talking. Must have been Misty Beethoven.
Carter was mentioning the same line he was just talking about.
Ripe Mangoes, Take One.
Yes.
And I think it was the opening of Misty Beethoven.
Okay.
And I knew this gal. We used to ride our bikes in the village. So I don't want to be known as the aficionado.
No, I'm just bringing it up. It's,
but,
yes.
No, I don't care.
Now, you shouldn't. Terry Hall?
Terry Hall.
Yep.
Bingo.
Oh,
bingo.
My goodness.
Bingo.
I'm sitting here with major experts.
I don't think she's alive anymore. I had read recently
really?
She wasn't. But yes, Terry Hall.
Oh, yes, she was fantastic.
She was great.
Yep. And you knew her?
Vaguely. To ride a bike around. I sat in a porn movie once with C.J. Lang.
Oh.
She was going to see her own movie.
Joe was in love with the image of C.J. Lang.
Well, she came and sat next to me. She wanted to know what I thought of the movie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that was my next question, and you're jumping right to it. Did you ever visit Manhattan during the early 1970s and actually visit what's known as a grind theater?
I would say once a week, my lunch at William Morris was spent on 42nd Street.
Wow.
Not only with X, but I would see the Kung Fu movie. I would see what all the stuff that Tarantino likes, I would go see.
So business people would take a lunch and pop into these things.
Yeah, no doubt.
Was this after Deep Throat?
Around the same time.
Do you think that Deep Throat really legitimized adult theater so that people who maybe thought it was seedy once Deep Throat hit the pop culture felt a little more at ease of going into a theater?
Maybe outside of New York, but not in New York.
Okay.
New York, we accepted it all along.
Right.
We didn't need Deep Throat to make it legit.
Right.
Probably outside of New York.
Any personal experiences, or can you sort of paint a picture for our listeners as to what 42nd Street was like in, let's say, 1974. What would you experience just walking down the street?
Well, okay, so you have to picture that I would take the bus to Port Authority every day to go to William Morris. And William Morris is on 55th, and I would get off 42nd Street, or 41st is where the bus station was. And then I would say each morning, how am I going to get to William Morris today? Am I going to go sleazy?
Oh.
Or am I going to go legit? Or am I going to go scary? So scary was to go up 9th Avenue and cut over to the right to 55th. And legit was to go up 5th Avenue and cut over to the left. And sleazy was to go 42nd Street to 8th Avenue. I never felt uncomfortable.
Is there a reason why 9th
I just felt sleazy.
Is there a reason why 9th Avenue was called Hell's Kitchen?
Yeah, it was scary.
How scary? Tell me. Like, what type of scenario would you... Because 9th Avenue now, as of, you know, we're in 2010, restaurants have, like, outside seating on 9th Avenue and 42nd.
Yeah. No, I carried a briefcase, and I remember often on the 9th Avenue run to William Morris, I would hold it under my arm.
Okay.
As opposed to holding it by the handle, which is where I would hold it normally on any of the other streets. I wasn't scared enough to not do it.
This is during the day.
This was during the day.
Would you take scary on the way back if it was dark?
It started to get dark in the winters at 5:30, and I would often not do that. That's when I would go 8th or 7th or 6th.
So for young folks listening, would it be like a video game scenario? You're walking down the street and people would pop out of doorways and steal something from you.
No, but they'd ask you for money.
Yeah.
Constantly.
What happens now?
Yeah.
No, but a little bit more insistent.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't that they were sitting there playing a guitar and if you wanted to throw 50 cents in, they would follow you a little bit and say, hey, man, why not? You know, they.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it wasn't so much. I think people left other New Yorkers alone. I always felt comfortable. But you would be watching fights. You'd be seeing arguments. They were not high class hookers that you were walking by. But 42nd Street was fun. 42nd Street was like going in a fun house or a haunted house.
Well, people today think 42nd Street is fun just in a different way.
It's Disneyized,
yeah,
or if that's a word. No, it was all for a movie lover. It was either X-rated movies or the kung fu movies or wonderful sleazy horror movies. I Spit on Your Grave, Don't Look in the Basement, that kind of stuff. And they were all triple features or triple or four features. I don't think people even remember what double features are anymore.
Right.
But on 42nd Street, you would see four movies for your $2.
Right.
Were you ever accosted or solicited in any of these theaters?
By?
Just other people sitting there like...
No, everybody was very respectful if you were in the theater.
Really?
Not at all. Except for C.J. Lang sitting down and say, what do you think?
Did you know that it was C.J. Lang or...
The minute I saw her next to me, yes.
That's pretty fantastic.
Because I was watching her movie.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was interesting. It's sort of a sense around kind
now,
of a thing.
Now, before we segue out of this, I have to ask, how did you become so friendly with Terry Hall so as to go bike riding with her?
I don't remember. It's all under a cloud of smoke a little bit. I don't remember.
Right.
Okay. I don't remember.
I guess I'll accept that.
I was haunting Kim's video store on Bleecker. It was really an underground video store.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And I think maybe we chanced upon each other there, and we were all doing, we would go to all the off-Broadway, the performance garage. A lot of it had to do with the real strange off-Broadway theater, which you don't have now anymore either. I remember one review of a play. The whole review was frequent and prolonged nudity. That's what the calling card to that show was.
Wow.
You could get to see frequent and prolonged nudity.
Well, they must have got a lot of customers.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Of course.
If a listener who is younger and did not experience this, would you recommend a film like Taxi Driver for folks to get an idea, a visual of what we're talking about as far as what 42nd Street looked like?
I never experienced that kind of violence.
Okay.
But visually, sure.
Yeah.
But no, I...
The way theater... Like, theaters were one after another. Theater.
Yes. Yeah, you'd get a look at it. That, I think, was exaggerated in terms of the underworld.
Right.
It wasn't that scary. But sure, that's what it would look like.
Yeah.
Absolutely, that's what it would look like.
So back to the video store.
Okay.
So you opened up two stores. First of all, it must have been... did you have a grand opening? It must have been very exciting.
It was very exciting. I'm thinking back to the policies. You used to make people join for $75, and you'd say a lifetime membership. And I remember thinking to myself, if I were asked, I'd say, whose life? Mine? Yours? The store's? And all of that got worn down.
Right.
You would initially take an actual physical deposit that you'd give back, whereas later that became you just carry the fellow's credit card.
Right.
We had a system, which was an annoying system. The boxes were empty and filled with styrofoam, and they were out on the floor, and all the movies were in brown plastic hard cases behind the counter.
Yes.
And that doesn't happen anymore either.
Well, unless it's a really old-timey store still around.
Right.
We're talking about VHS here, just so everyone knows.
Yeah, no.
No.
I was out of it way before that happened. And Laserdisc had that interim anyway. But it was very exciting. And I remember thinking in the beginning, you just kept getting cash. You just kept getting $6, $6,
yes.
$6, $6 all day long. Now, that didn't last very long. But while it did, you almost thought you were, you know, dealing in heroin or something. All this cash was going across the counter. Didn't last long.
Yeah. Well, a few years, no?
Pretty soon it got tightened. I don't really totally remember, but I know we had to $75 membership, then became $50,
right.
And you had to give the $25 back to your other members, and then in very short order, it became free membership. That was your calling card in the window.
What was the average rental price per VHS back in the day?
Well, somewhere along the line, in the beginning, the movies would sell for probably $39. And they would cost us half. But somewhere along the line, they decided that movies that were going to be rented were going to be $99.
Yes.
And that's when everyone stopped buying them for their home collection. Now, yeah, there was a very bad period when they were $99.
That was tough on you as well.
It was awful on us. And I think that's when a Walmart or that type of store would buy them in bulk, and they were selling them to customers cheaper than we were buying them wholesale. And that was the beginning of the end.
And this is early, mid-80s we're talking. So basically...
When you'd only buy two or three copies...
Yeah.
There was no such thing as, we promise if the copy isn't here. No, you had three copies, and they were usually out. The other problem, I know I'm rambling.
No.
The other problem was 99% of the customers only wanted what came out on a Tuesday. So if you had stock, I'd say 80% of your stock titles never rented.
Really?
And only the 20% of the new titles, very few people would go pull, can I do it till I need glasses off the shelf, or one of those titles. It just wouldn't.
How popular was the adult room?
Oh, totally popular.
Totally.
Oh, that was always popular.
Was that, I mean, what percentage of your business would that be?
40.
Okay.
And those were never $99.
In your, okay.
Those were always cheap.
in your experience, was it perfectly acceptable as long as it's in a back room, or did an eyebrow go up in the community and you any resistance from
no,
the community?
No, not in either of the two communities I was in.
Okay.
We weren't in Westfield or...
Right. So during this tenure, so to speak, at your video stores, somewhere you still had your video store when you decided to shoot a movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
There was an incident in the video store that made it all happen.
Okay.
You want to... Now should I tell you that story?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And I had a Lenny Bruce sensibility, and I'll explain what that... Several years earlier, I played Lenny Bruce at Celebration Playhouse in the play Lenny. And Lenny Bruce, there's a monologue that Lenny delivers, and it's probably in the Dustin Hoffman film too, where he talks about nudity is the worst thing in the world to 99% of the people, where violence is completely acceptable. You can't show a, and I'm quoting him, you can't show a pretty pair of nice titties, but if the titties are cut off and bloody, it's perfectly acceptable. Okay, well, that was, I did that maybe 6 years earlier. All right, I'm in the video store. And if memory serves, a rather pretty girl holding a child in her arm, a toddler, and a one that can walk but tall enough to hold her hand, brings Blood Cult up to the counter. Now, I think that was one of the first shot on videos.
Yes.
Okay, so she brings Blood Cult up to the title. No, I Dismember Mama.
Okay.
She brings I Dismember Mama up to the counter. And she says, does this have any nudity? And I'm taken back, and I'm thinking I'm Lenny Bruce. And I say, well, I can't swear to the nudity, but there's dismemberment, there's heads cut off, there's guts falling out. She says, oh, well, that's okay. The kids can watch it as long as there isn't any nudity. My jaw fell open.
Right.
I rented her the tape, but I couldn't get that out of my mind. Well, that became the impetus to write Video Violence. And that scene is recreated in Video Violence.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is.
That's what it was all about. I was really, truly agog. To this day, I still am, that the violence was perfectly acceptable. And we're not talking even taxi driver violence. We're talking gore for gore's sake.
Right.
Whereas the nudity wasn't. So that prompted... I told the story to Paul Kay, a friend of mine, who at the time was selling videos. He was on the distributor's end. In fact, he used to hawk Video Violence once it was made. And he and I sat down and started to write a script around that incident. And one thing led to another.
Right. While you were running your video store, were you also still active in theater?
Yes. Again, the time frame confuses me. But I was certainly directing and occasionally acting in other theaters.
Right.
And it wasn't until 86. In 1980, I directed Oliver at Plays in the Park, the year I left William Morris. Then I didn't come back to Plays in the Park until 1986. And that's when I did Sweeney Todd. And then it took off from there. By 89, I was ensconced in at
right.
the place.
When you started putting your ideas together to what became Video Violence, tell me about your thoughts and experiences of, you know, just the kind of the concept of putting a movie together. Did you think about, oh my gosh, I need to get a film camera. Hey, we're going to shoot this on video. Tell me how that kind of bubbled and came to the surface.
All right. Well, first of all, this was right at the time. This is interesting to me going back this memory lane. This was right at the time where porn stopped being 35mm film.
Just like in Boogie Nights.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And started being video.
Yes.
So being a gadget freak, I had good video cameras, and I had some of the first VHS editing decks. I had a Panasonic VHS editing deck where you slaved two decks together, and it wasn't like now with DV, where I think it's called non-destructive. This was completely destructive.
Your tapes would actually be shuttling back and forth.
Shuttling back and
physically
forth.
Physically making edits, going from one tape to the second VCR.
And losing quality. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Unlike
and TV. Beating the heck out of your tapes.
And beating the heck out of it. So, but we had all this equipment. So we said, I wonder if we can make a movie. Well, we're not going to make a porn movie. It seems like the only other thing that lends itself to shot on video is horror.
At that time, was Blood Cult already out?
I think that was the only one.
Okay.
And we had it. We had it in the store. So we were inspired by Blood Cult, by porn, by this equipment. That nobody owned a VHS. Everybody had little Super 8 cameras and stuff.
Right.
Very few people then, because it was very expensive. You kept the tape on your shoulder.
In a deck.
In a deck that you carried, or in a deck, right. And the camera was this huge thing that had to sit on your shoulder.
Connected by a wire to the deck.
Totally connected by a wire.
Right.
So we set out to say, yes, we can make a horror movie. And our goal was just to see our box in a video store. There wasn't any goal past that. We didn't think we were going to suddenly become rich. We wanted to say we did it.
Right.
And when we made the movie, and we cut it at cable, at the local cable station, till they kicked us out when they saw what we were doing.
Did you edit on VHS, or did you quote-unquote bump your tapes to a higher format?
No, neither. Video Violence 2 was shot and edited on VHS, and so was Captives. Oh, and that's good, right. I'm trying to think of how we got from... Some of Video Violence was on my personal VHS stuff, but we got someone with U-Matic.
U-Matic was known as 3/4-inch video,
yeah.
Which cable stations used to shoot their news and local programming.
So we shot a good deal of that on 3/4 U-Matic, the first movie.
U-Matic, that was a professional format which existed before what was known as Betacam.
Right,
which
right.
became a professional format for news and everyone in the late 80s, 86 and on.
I guess U-Matic was more robust.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't great. And you still lost quality when you made copies.
Yes.
But it was more, you could shuttle it without worrying that it was going to flake off.
It was a professional format, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very robust.
So Comcast let us cut the movie after hours, and it was about 4 in the morning when someone came in and saw the violence and said, get out of here. Our staff is coming back in at 6 o'clock. Get out of here.
Which Comcast was this?
Avenel.
Okay.
Lord Street and Avenel.
Okay.
Remember it well. So, yes, so that was done on 3/4, and then we felt we could do it just as well on 1/2-inch.
Right.
Especially Video Violence 2, which was really about shooting on 1/2-inch.
1/2-inch,
so
by the way,
so what was the difference?
1/2-inch is VHS tape.
Right.
Yes.
So what was the difference? And then there was Super VHS.
Oh, yes. Did you do any of Super VHS?
Sure. I think Video Violence 2 was Super VHS.
Joe Colbeck, who's sitting with us, would know, were there a variety of formats in the box from Gary when we re-edited?
Well, I believe two was Super VHS, correct?
Oh, okay.
That probably just came out as we were halfway through.
And yeah, and like you said, the first one was
was the U-Matic.
Was the U-Matic, yeah. I
call it 3/4.
Yeah. Plus a couple of VHS. The stuff that had to look like it was being shot through the camera, in other words, a POV,
right.
We did on VHS and bumped it up to 3/4.
Right. Right.
Remastering Video Violence and Video Violence 2, if I could describe, for me at least here, you know, at camp, was like a fever dream. Because you brought this huge box of tape to our studio sometime in 07. And I remember looking at it, and that box, it must have sat for a year. At least, we put it in our fax room, and it sat there, and I remember just looking at it, thinking,
oh my.
And it wasn't...
I couldn't give you the 3/4-inch master, because that other company had
So
I couldn't have given you the master.
Right.
So I had to give you the tapes that we made the master from.
And that's why we went back to
the
originals.
That's why you went to do it.
Yes, yes. And it was, and then Joe Colbeck, when you came on, we first launched Camp Motion Pictures, and I don't remember how exactly it came up. Like, let's remaster this.
Well, you had told me that you had the rights.
Okay.
And I had seen Video Violence when I was much younger, and I jumped at that. I'm like, I remember that one. I remember it. So I guess my enthusiasm is why if the project fell into my lap.
Right.
And you know, the task of actually restoring it was, and I don't want to sound like it's pejorative, It was daunting. It was insufferable.
How did you deal with the soundtrack? Technically, I don't know how you did it.
Okay, well...
Or did I give you the little cassettes of the music?
The
music was on cassette.
Oh, no.
Yes, the music was on cassette, but what we did is I think we used the soundtrack that was already on... Okay, how I did it was...
Yeah, I want to know.
We had a dub. We had a dub from a VHS copy of the film.
Okay. Finished film.
Finished, yes. That is the soundtrack that was used. It was taken from your master copy of the VHS of the film. You had like a master
edit. I had the U-matic, we made one VHS for me to keep.
Yes, and okay. That's what we used for the sound. Now, when you do a match frame, because I'm bringing this up because I had to match frame to remaster, is you find the frame that's native to the sequence, and then you find it in your raw footage, and it's as simple as hitting match frame. And then
you need time code, which we didn't even know what that was.
The Avid syncs it up. But since this footage was coming from this was not organic, this was not native to the sequence, it was coming from all these various different sources, all these different tapes, I had to go in through the sequence, find the frame, and then go through the footage, all of the footage, to find that frame from the film, and then sync it up.
Wow. So for each cut in the film?
For each cut, yeah.
If I knew that, I would have told you to trim some things.
Oh,
There were some things that were too long, I thought.
Oh, well, sorry.
So actually, you were replacing digitally in an Avid system, basically putting from the camera original image on top of and replacing from the sort of, generation lost VHS.
Yes, that's... Yeah.
Did you sweeten the soundtrack at all?
I threw some filters on there to sort of eliminate some of the hiss and stuff like that. I don't know how well it worked. Did you notice, did it sound like there was a difference?
It sounded cleaner.
It sounded clean. Okay, then I guess
I heard the dialogue better.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
But I'm not sure that's a good thing, but I heard the dialogue better.
Regardless of what, the outcome of the release from a financial perspective, I feel in a way that we've restored the film for a new generation to enjoy, and the DVD is the best possible, better than what was originally released.
Yep.
Okay, so to back up, so you had all this equipment, you shot. Because of your experience in theater, was it fairly easy to cast?
Oh, yeah. That was the fun part, especially with captives, where I think we have some really fine performers in that. But again, I can't see it happening now. I love Lambertsville and Frenchtown and New Hope, and I would spend weekends there. And the bridge in Frenchtown to Pennsylvania seemed like a cool place to make the movie. We wrote to the mayor of Frenchtown and said, can we make a horror movie in your town? The guy said, yeah.
Yeah.
You can't do that now.
No.
So similar happened with the actors. By the time we got to Video Violence 2, I put ads in backstage and we got people. But for Video Violence 1, it was, hey, you want to be in this movie? Yeah. And I won't mention a name, but we needed the gal who gets her breasts sliced up by Howard and Eli. So we needed someone, Zoftig, who would do this. And I remember my friend said, what's her name? Is in the back of the car. Go ask her. If she wants to do it. I stuck my head in the car. I said, do you want to be in Video Violence? She said, what do I have to do? I said, well, you have to show your tits. She said, okay, and lifted her t-shirt. I'm exemplifying that here on the mic. And I said, well, okay, you got the part. And it winds up, she has subsequently become a rabbi.
Oh.
So that's why I'm not mentioning names. But anyway, that is the feeling back then. Everybody wanted to be in it. Everybody wanted to know how they're going to die. What crazy way can you find for me to die? I want to die in some great way. And that was the feeling back
then. It sounds like there was a lot of energy in the air to get this done.
Oh, there was a lot of energy, yeah.
Now, while you were shooting and editing, were you trying to secure some type of distribution? You being a video store owner, you, of course, want to see this on the shelves in video stores. So at the time, and by the way, this is an age-old question that still stands today, everyone out there that's listening that wants to make a movie wants to know, how am I going to get on Netflix?
Okay.
How am I going to get in Blockbuster? Back then, what was going on?
Okay, we waited till the film was done, and then we looked on the back of all the boxes in the video store that weren't Warner Brothers and weren't MGM. And there were probably, and I have the paperwork somewhere, there probably were a dozen companies that had one or two sleazy movies each.
Right.
United being one of them. I can't even remember the other names. So we made a dozen copies with a letter, and we blindly sent them out. And let's say we sent 10. 8 turned us down, and 2 said yes. And we were jumping up and down. And one of them said yes, and it wasn't a particularly good deal. And Camp said yes, and it was a great deal. They were going to make a poster, they were going to make one-sheets, right. They were going to get us in magazines. We jumped on it.
Right. This is the original Camp video from the West Coast.
Yeah.
That put out a lot of direct shot on video. Do some titles come to mind that you know
but
of,
But I think we were Camp? Well, yes. Gourmet Chef from Hell.
Yes, Gourmet Zombie Chef from Hell.
Gourmet Zombie Chef
from Hell. Cannibal Camp Out,
yes.
Of course.
Slime City.
Slime City, right, yes.
But I think we were the first.
Okay.
Or one of the first. Obviously, they had to have something for us to even know that they existed. Right. I had to have bought one of their titles. So they put us
Hollywood
out
for Chainsaw Hookers.
That was Camp video?
Yes.
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 But that was later. They were then getting some notoriety.
Yes.
They put us out on the big box. They submitted us to some sort of festival.
Oh.
And we were nominated for Best Movie. And then it came out in a second release in the small box with a little gold star that said nominated for Best Movie in some sort of festival.
Mm-hmm.
American Film Institute Festival.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't slouchy.
That sounds prestigious.
Yeah. So that's how we did it. We did it innocently, naively, and successfully. And then while we're discussing Video Violence 2 with Camp, that's when I decided to shoot Captives and do something serious. Captives was a serious attempt.
Captives is in between the first two Video Violences?
And Video Violence, both of those were always tongue-in-cheek.
Right.
But Captives was my attempt at not being tongue-in-cheek.
What was the vibe at the time you finished Video Violence? Did you enjoy the experience enough to think, well, you know what? I'm going to continue to make films.
Yes.
Okay.
No doubt.
Okay.
I mean, in all honesty, innocently, it was pretty easy to even get it bought.
Right. Was it your idea for a Video Violence 2, or while you're making Captives, Camp asked you for a part 2?
It was definitely our idea, but we asked Camp if they wanted to go in on it. Now, I'm a little vague. I think Camp said, we won't pay for any of your expenses, but we will cut you in on a profit deal.
Okay.
And that's what fell apart, and that's when we had to try to sue them, and la, la, la.
Right.
But they didn't pay for any of it, but we were supposed to get money back.
Right. Which is good, because you own the movies.
We were happy with all of that. Even sending it to the Library of Congress was a hoot. Here we were sending
absolutely.
Our movies and getting them in the Library of Congress.
Yes.
Do you remember what the budgets were on the first two?
You know, it's so funny when I hear budgets for movies. There was no budget. Budget means you sat down and you say, I think it's going to cost. This was when we needed a roll of tape, a reel of tape. We went and we bought it. There wasn't a budget. There wasn't a budget. There was a guy who wanted to be a part of it. In fact, in Video Violence, he's the one that's digging the hole in the backyard, and then he goes into the house and he's eating and watching, right? Yes. And going, oh, that's good. He had some money. So he gave us money when we needed it. Literally, I'd be shocked if it cost more than $500.
Wow. Okay.
I'd be shocked.
Okay.
Because everybody was doing it for free and a supposed point.
Was the second one more expensive?
Yeah.
It's a little more, you know, you have like a little bit more.
We had to buy for the stuff that was going to blow up and the makeup and the blood.
Right.
And we went to a butcher and got intestines.
Right.
I mean, we had to pay for more stuff.
Now, the effects, I know these gentlemen as the two marks.
Yeah.
Because at the time I was working for Comcast in the Meadowlands, and I was shooting a lot of behind the scenes on movies for fun, and I had a cable show, and I did a behind the scenes on a film called Goblins.
Yeah,
which was directed by Mick Cribben, which became Warning Children at Play.
Yes.
And that's where I met the guys known as the two Marks.
Two Marks. Mark Dolson and Mark Quiatek.
Yes. How did you meet these gentlemen?
Mark Dolson still does special effects for Plays in the Park for me.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Still does. He made the guillotine for Scarlet Pimpernel. Still right to this past summer.
Fantastic.
But how did I meet them? I'm going to want to say through the video store. I think that's how I met everybody.
Was it the type of situation? Because, I mean, you're talking about what's now known as practical effects, prosthetic effects. Did you have little round tables where you're like, okay, what kind of creepy effect are we going to do? You know, hand cutting off or... You know, how did you come up with the gore aspect of the film?
We shared it. Either we would come up with something that I thought would be fun, and they jumped on saying, okay, here's how we would do it. Or in a number of cases, they said, hey, we happen to have left over, or we've been playing with, can you incorporate that in it? So we'd write the scene based on what was available to us. So a little bit of both. A little bit of both.
Right. Were there staple people you worked with that brought it all together, or same crew on both films?
No. Actors, yes. They were all my friends from Pleasant Park.
Right.
But there was a filmmaking crew involved in the second one.
Okay.
With their equipment, which was slightly better than my equipment. Still VHS.
Right,
SVHS. They're actually in the movie, too, in Video Violence 2. You can see them making the movie. Right. But they were a company. I was behind the camera through most of Captives and most of Video Violence 1, but I wasn't in Video Violence 2. That was a group of people that made movies.
Yes. After Video Violence, you mentioned Captives was a much more serious subject matter before doing Video Violence 2. How were you thinking about Captives while making Video Violence? How did you...
I was thinking about that on the way to Butler, and I think it started this way. I think I found in the video store... No, I wasn't necessarily thinking about it during Video Violence 1, because we knew nothing was going to... Who knew what was going to happen with that? I found a piece of 8mm film, a reel of 8mm film, and it was of a house burning down, and it was really neat looking. I mean, I feel bad for the people in for the house burning down, but it was a neat piece of film. That gave me the impetus to write the script for Captives. I actually crafted the whole story around thinking that I wanted to incorporate this 8mm film in this house burning. Yeah.
So you wrote the script?
I wrote the script. Okay. I wrote the script to Video Violence 2 and Captives. I co-wrote it with Paul, the first film.
Right. Some of the same folks from the Video Violence movies are in Captives as well, yes?
Yes.
Very nice. And because we don't, here at the studio, we have much less elements for Captives, I think. I don't think we have as much. I think you just had a few tapes.
Oh, the reason I have a few tapes, they're all on those tapes, but we, instead of just devoting a tape to a scene, which is what we would have done with Video Violence, here we just keep going on a tape, so it would be even harder to reconstruct, because I don't think it's labeled at all.
Right.
You might have a two-hour tape that has six different scenes from the movie.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Was the experience on Captives similar from a technical perspective?
I think I was a lot more tense during Captives. I felt more at stake, and I don't remember having a whole lot of fun.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, there's a scene, I'm in Captives, and I'm the nasty husband, and there's a scene where I back my new Camaro, back it out of a garage. And I think I was so tense, I remember backing it out of the garage, and I took the driver's side mirror right off and a piece of the garage. And that's in the film. You see it. So, I mean, that started me off. I knew I had a big bill to pay on my poor little car. So I don't remember being too happy during Captives.
Do you feel that you're a different person now than when you were back then with the video store directing the movies? Like was your disposition, so to speak, different?
Yeah. Yeah, I was angrier back then. I was an angry young man, and I would direct even the plays with an intolerance for it not going smoothly and for things going wrong. And I'm not that anymore.
Right.
I haven't been that for a while.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you feel that, and I'm saying this because a lot of young filmmakers listen to the podcast, that, you know, do you feel it has anything to do with the ego or the whole, you know, you're a director and you're in charge of so many people? Like, looking back at your younger self, which I guess you would do differently now.
Totally differently.
Yeah. There's something said for the aging process.
Yeah, I still would want the same product.
Right.
I still would be whatever version of a perfectionist I am, but I'd be much more tolerant of other people's process.
Right.
In the theater, you have actors who come day one and their character is pretty much nailed. And then you have actors who would take the full 4 weeks of rehearsal to get there.
Right.
And I'm not, I hadn't been tolerant to them. And now it's their process.
Right. So by your experiences over the years, you are able to now see that some actors just need more time and you're...
Absolutely.
Do you see young directors on stage? So you almost see your the way you used to be? Is that still, is a young person thing? Or just...
No. Well, maybe. Yeah, I could. Yes, I'll buy into that. Some of the younger directors are less tolerant.
Okay, because I'm assuming that you also do some producing now, and you'll have someone else.
Well,
direct.
I have to produce every show at the theater, and I only direct the first one each summer. So yes, I do. But some of the directors are my age as well.
Right.
Yeah,
that's very interesting.
In fact, the guy who was the vampire in both Video Violence 1 and Video, he still directs with me, David Christopher. Sure.
Oh, very nice.
And he's actually older than me.
Why is it that Captives sort of fell through the cracks? Why didn't it get the splashy, you know, Camp video release?
I wish I could tell you why Camp didn't take it. I have no recollection at all. The company that did take it, however, were terrible. I mean, they simply were terrible.
Right.
Camp, through every stage of the release, worked with us. They were terribly inventive in the poster and the artwork, but they always asked us for our opinions on it.
Right.
And what should we do? And do you want to do an interview for this? This company, whose name I don't even remember, who took Captives, we never heard from them again. They took a picture on the front cover that is not in the movie of people I don't know, and it's terribly misleading. They changed the name to Mama's Home, and two technical things that they did to add insult to injury is they completely obliterated our first 5-minute title sequence, and then the sound goes out of sync halfway through.
Oh.
I got my copies of it, and that was the end of that.
So even though there was, you mentioned, some problem with Camp towards the end, the way you describe it, there seems to be a relationship here where they actually consulted with you.
The problems were never on a personal level.
Right.
I thought Camp was great. I did not think the Mama's Home company was great.
Right.
And I don't even know, I would go to a Chiller Theater convention throughout the years.
Yes, Chiller Theater.
And invariably, there would be more than one copy of Video Violence and Video Violence 1 out there in bins for
sale. On VHS.
On VHS, which means there were copies. That movie sold to some degree. I rarely would see Mama's Home.
Well, about Mama's Home, collecting VHS has become like collecting vinyl now.
Is that true?
Yes, there are people now that just, they're obsessed with collecting VHS. And I have a friend who collects VHS. He has a massive VHS collection. It's like lining his walls. And Mama's Home is actually one of the holy grails.
He has it?
Yes.
He has it?
No, he does not have it.
Oh.
He saw, as a matter of fact, he contacted me yesterday because I think you threw, I'm not on the, I don't exist on the internet.
Okay.
So he told me that you.
Yes,
you,
there's a blog.
There's a blog and there's a something for Mama's Home.
There's the box.
Oh, is that him?
I wouldn't know, somebody
who mentioned Mama's Home.
Yeah.
He contacted me, said he wanted to know if I had a copy of Mama's Home here. He's like, can you get it to me? I'll buy it, blah blah. I'm totally ignorant. I have no idea.
He's gonna be very happy to know that, you know, this package is coming out.
I think I only have one.
Oh, you own a packaged.
I have one VHS of Mama's Home in a box. I only have one though. I do have that.
So you think that maybe the distribution just was not good for Mama's Home.
I don't know what to think. I really don't know what to think. But what they did to it, it's just awful.
Yeah.
They took the opening sequence, which sets up the whole movie, sets up the two neighborhoods and the two types of people, cut it all off, took the music out, and instead regurgitated scenes from the whole rest of the movie in a title montage. So really, on Mama's Home, all you need is the first 5 minutes. You got the whole movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a real shame, because that opening montage you did with the paperboy was wonderful.
That was fun, and that was hard to film, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, but it came together very nicely.
And that's gone. It's just gone.
Now, what did they do? They took your master and actually did some editing?
Yeah, they chopped that off.
Why do you... You don't know why?
I have no idea. We never heard from them again.
Were you busy working on Video Violence 2? So just basically, you were between that and the video store, that time just went by and...
No. I think I wrote to them all the time.
Oh, okay.
I do. I think I was pretty angry.
Were they on the West Coast?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'll go home and look on the box, man. It doesn't seem like they were on the West Coast. It seems like they were somewhere right in the middle of the two coasts, somewhere in the West.
Do you remember seeing Video Violence showing up in a catalog from your video store where you could actually order it?
Oh, absolutely. I have still at home a very, very thick paperback catalog of a reasonably famous company, and there's both movies in
there. It might be an Ingram. Baker and Taylor.
No, Baker and Taylor I know because they were right by my store in Bound Brook.
Okay.
This was an Ingram.
Oh, okay, Ingram. Yeah, big book distributor and video distributor.
And then I was very proud that Video Violence and Video Violence 2 showed up in a authoritative intellectual hardcover book about violence in the cinema.
Right.
And they gave us half a page. And it went everything from, who was that politician that shot himself in the head? And everything from talking about Arbaugh Dwyer to those series of movies that were, were they real or not, Faces of Death.
Yes.
Right.
And then it talks about us,
but,
too.
But were they castigating your movie? Or were they praising it as satire, like a brilliant satire or something? Like,
none of that.
None of that.
It was an intellectual kind of a collegiate study.
Oh, okay. All right.
Saying then this came out and then this came out.
Okay.
But we were in it nonetheless.
Right.
While Captives was out with various distributors, seeing if anyone would pick it up, Camp came back. I guess Camp didn't want Captives because it was serious and didn't fall under the moniker of being Camp. But they came back to us and said, yeah, go ahead. Come up with Video Violence 2. And they didn't want to see a script or anything.
Oh.
They just said, go do your thing. And Video Violence 2 went off in a very different direction.
Yes, it did.
Than the first movie. So it sort of was. Video Violence was a tongue-in-cheek and yet a basic, serious story, at least in my mind. Captives was a terribly serious story and meant to be dramatic. So Video Violence 2 was our release.
Mm-hmm.
That was us being completely silly.
But just as fun to watch.
Yeah, yeah. That was saying, all right, if nudity's no good and violence is okay, we're going to throw it all at you. And we're going to make the nudity violent. And it was just us poking fun at the prudes who don't like nudity. Okay. My favorite is where they do something with the guy's veins, and they pull his veins and it makes the middle finger come up.
Yes, the
war. Was at the time, in the early 80s, that Faces of Death, did that influence you at all to say like, oh my God, this is so over the top?
No, I didn't watch it. It was in the video store. Before I got to watch it, a number of customers said it sucks. And so I didn't bother. Only in my older age did I get a real appreciation for trash.
Right.
You know, only now do I have an extensive collection of real trash. Back then, if they said it wasn't good, I took them on their word and I didn't watch it. So no, I didn't see Faces of Death until much later.
That's interesting. So Video Violence 2, you knew you had a distributor.
Yeah, and we did that one knowing it was going to get out.
Yeah, so you finished it up, sent it to Camp, and...
And yes, and they sent us a poster.
You really like the packaging. I believe you said to us, hey, listen, will there be a poster? I don't know, did we do a poster?
No, I wanted you to have a great a DVD box.
Right.
And you went out of your way with that wonderful insert with the guy talking about the movies.
Yes.
Look, we're not going to make money on it, so I would love it to be packaged well.
Right, right.
That's the thing I'm most proud of.
Right.
I should also say, all these movies were made under my little company, which was called Little Zach Productions. My son was born in 1986, and he's now 25. Captives, he's a star of it.
Oh, okay, yes.
He's featured, he's a major player. In fact, we had to make a little mechanical Zach for the scene where he gets almost suffocated.
Right.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Little Zach Productions.
Video Violence 2, it's finished, it's packaged, it's out. You know, every exciting experience, there's always a beginning and the peak, and then, unfortunately, things do come to an end and people move on. You had this great burst of energy. You made these three films. What happened? What happened to the idea of making more movies or the video store?
Okay. Well, we had ideas of making more movies, and there's two different versions of Video Violence 3. But times changed. Shot on video was not being accepted anymore. Simply put, you couldn't market anything but X-rated come the end of the 80s.
You talk about low-budget indie movies.
Right. That had to be now on film. Video was not being accepted. And it only became accepted again when DV meant that you could really do a professional-looking thing on amateur equipment. So there was a period there where we weren't going to be able to sell it at all.
This is before Blair Witch sensibilities, in a sense that...
Considerably before.
Video was so new, people were thrilled to have anything on VHS. Do you think that the audience became a little more picky or fickle?
No doubt. Then they wanted Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Then they wanted it shot on film again. They didn't want the shot on video. We could not afford to make a movie, so there was no market any longer to do it. I'd make a movie in a heartbeat now on DV.
Yeah.
But between then and now, there was no market. It was gone. It was simply gone. I guess I felt the way that I felt when my off-Broadway play closed And when my two books came out,
right.
I did it.
Right.
I did it. I can point to it. And I would say once a month, I go on the internet, and Video Violence 1 and Video Violence 2 has a presence. It's
yes,
all over the internet.
Yeah.
People have, nobody feels indifferent about it. They either love it or they hate
right.
it. And I love reading about both. But it's out there.
Yeah.
It's out there.
Yeah. I haven't checked. Are there a number of reviews on like
yes.
Amazon.com?
Yeah. Oh, there are reviews everywhere. International Movie Database has reviews.
Oh, okay.
I even for a while had my own website for Video Violence, but I started getting some weird
yeah.
stuff, so I killed it.
Yeah.
But it's out there, and it's got a love-hate relationship with a lot of people.
There was some chit-chat, some chatter about the concept of a Video Violence 3.
I have two half scripts.
Do you think, did we miss anything about Video Violence, Captives, or Video Violence, Video Violence 2, or anything about your career?
The only thing I'm thinking about, Captives.
Yes.
I wouldn't change Video Violence 1 or 2 for the world. I'd make a third one, but
yeah.
I wouldn't change those. I feel the basic script of Captives is good enough that it could be a real movie.
Right.
And sadly, DV didn't exist then. We could have, had we shot that in DV and edited in DV and even made it look like film, it might have gotten more respect. But over the last 10 years or so, I've sent the movie to different people who were into independent film and said, hey, take a look at this. Would you like to redo this? And I haven't gotten a bite yet. But where I'm completely happy, not only no regrets, I love Video Violence and
right.
Video Violence too. I have regrets over Captives.
Right.
I think it could have been a contender.
Well, Gary, it's really thrilling to have you here.
Oh, this was great. Thank
and,
you.
And it's going to be most thrilling to go to Kit Hong
oh.
on Route 23 in Kinlan, New Jersey, and have a Chinese feast.
Great.
So,
very nice.
I hope everyone enjoyed this conversation with Gary P. Cohen and our good friend Joe Kolbeck. And it's been my thrill. It's a real thrill to chat in detail about all this stuff in the 1970s and the 80s and VHS. So until next time, I'm signing off.
That was great.
That was great.
Yeah, fantastic.
She's throwing rocks again. Throwing rocks again. It's always personal. It started in the snow. She's hiding rocks under her mom. Such a headstrong slipping angel. Throwing rocks at me, denting my dignity, while dripping love's honey. Deep down inside my soul, I know I can't let go. She's hiding rocks under her mom. Each one her horn dead, screaming this out. Again, and blame it on my friends. She's throwing rocks again. Pretty but all alone, her only love is stone. These stones are holding down her. Throwing rocks again and blame it on my friends.